Hello, I'm Erica McIntyre, Content Director for Jason's Connection. Today our founder, Jason Harris, is going to be talking with Libby Harrison, Project Manager for the Cincinnati Exchange Project, a local advocacy organization that promotes education and the harm reduction model, committed to making the drug-using community healthier while increasing drug treatment enrollment.
Okay, great. So can you start off with what is the Cincinnati Exchange Project?
We are a syringe exchange project here in Cincinnati. We're one of only four different syringe exchanges in the state. We recently just gained Dayton as well. So we went from three to four in the last couple of weeks. And we provide clean injection equipment for an exchange for used injection equipment to reduce the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, as well as decreasing abscesses and other wound care issues, endocarditis, all of that stuff that can go along with injection drug use. Our site offers HIV testing, hepatitis C testing. Pretty soon here we'll be offering rapid syphilis testing because we also have a syphilis outbreak right now in our country, and pregnancy testing. So those are the basic things that we offer while we're on the van, because we are a mobile site, so we work out of a van. And then the rest of the time we do things to try to increase people's access to housing, health care, drug treatment, hepatitis treatment, HIV treatment, basically just trying to meet the needs of the community.
Wow. And so why did you start this program, or why did the program get started?
Well, we started here in Cincinnati because in about 2005, our medical director, Dr. Judith Feinberg, while working in the emergency rooms, noticed that there was a spike in endocarditis. And endocarditis is an infection in the lining of the heart, and it is generally almost always seen with injection drug use. And Cincinnati had not had a heroin problem prior to this. So that's when we started fighting for syringe exchange. It was 2005, 2006. It took us until 2014 to actually get a site open because the powers that be refused to recognize that there was a problem and did not like syringe exchange. They felt that it was enabling. They didn't see it as an option of health care. So that's why we got started, was just heroin hit the Midwest really hard, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know. You know, heroin hadn't really been a drug of the Midwest. It had been a coastal drug. And, you know, we're seeing epidemic rates of overdose as well as use. And so we felt we needed to take action.
Yeah, and so you've gone over this a little bit, but what does giving clean needles help with?
It helps to decrease disease. So there's a practical level and then there's a more social level. Practical level is we're decreasing disease. Hepatitis C can live out in the open air for weeks. And so if somebody uses a needle that's been used by somebody with hepatitis C, even if it was a while ago, they can still contract hepatitis C. And the treatment for hepatitis C is about $100,000. So you think that our program runs on about $70,000 a year. Granted, we'd like it to run on more, but that's what we have. You know, decreasing one case of hepatitis more than funds our program for a year. So that's the practical aspect of it. The more global or larger scale aspect is the injection drug use community is a very isolated community. I mean, what they do is illegal. So they keep themselves very isolated. They try to stay out of the big picture. They oftentimes don't go get health care because they don't want it in their chart that they are an injection drug user, especially now with the charting all being done online. And so it being so easy for doctors to share information, you know, it really takes away their privacy. So they avoid going to the doctor at all costs, where we act as a safe space. So as somebody who can be a voice for them, help them find safe medical care, help them find safe housing, and being the person who will walk in to a treatment place with them and sit with them as an advocate.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about it. How do you discuss the people who think you're enabling or allowing drug use? How do you sort of discuss that with them and sort of say, no, we're not?
Well, the fact of the matter is we are a one-for-one exchange. That is the way that it was set up with the city of Cincinnati. So somebody has to bring us a needle to get a needle. So the people who are coming to us are already injection drug users. We are meeting people where they're at. We don't create drug use. We didn't bring the heroin in. We are just a tool in the toolbox of fighting all of the stuff that goes with it. And our focus is disease prevention. And so that's where we keep our focus. Is, you know, if somebody wants to see us as enabling because we're giving people syringes, then they're not recognizing that people were injecting before we came around. They're not recognizing that people will pick up a syringe off of the street and use it. And they're not recognizing that we are here to fight disease. And we have a 10% success rate of our clients getting into drug treatment. And although 10% certainly seems low, if you got a 10% on a test, you'd be failing. But actually in the land of drug treatment, a 10% success rate is incredibly high.
Oh, wow. And I'm sure there's some people who ask, why is it important to keep drug users safe? They're obviously harming themselves. Do you have a response to that?
Yeah, oh, definitely. So the thing is most drug addicts quit using drugs. There's a reason we don't see a lot of William S. Burroughs out there of people who are using in their 70s, and it's because they quit using. And so it's easier to quit using when you have less baggage attached to it. You know, it's easier to quit when you don't have hepatitis C, when you don't have HIV. You know, that's motivation. I don't want these diseases. I don't have them yet. I'm going to try to stop before that happens. Because at our sites, we have a 78% hepatitis C positivity rate and a 4% HIV positivity rate. For HIV, the government considers it an epidemic if it goes past 1%.
Oh, wow. So how do you get the people in these communities to trust you guys?
It's a lot of word of mouth. So a lot of people who have heard of syringe exchanges from other parts of the country, because certainly this is not a new program overall. They've been on the coasts and some areas more inward for a long time. So they've heard of syringe exchange, so they know that it's a real program. And then most people refer their friends. So, you know, there's the average slow startup where we didn't see a lot of people. And now we're seeing roughly 70 people a week.
Oh, wow. And I guess you talked about having trouble getting support at first. How did you get support in cooperation from the local law enforcement and other neighborhood councils and stuff?
We went and we talked to them. We just had open conversations. We went to all the neighborhoods that we're in. We went to their business councils. We went to their community councils. With the police, we actually have a lot of support from the Cincinnati Police Department. We've got some great people who work for the police, who fight for us, who recognize that this actually helps keep the police safer as well. Because when police are doing pat-downs, they're at risk for getting stuck by a dirty needle. They'd rather have the risk that maybe it's a clean needle. So they recognize that this keeps them safer well, and they also recognize the rate of people that we get into treatment. And they appreciate that the job that we do.
Thank you. You talk about the statistics and how you get 10%, and I know that's how you get your funding too. What statistics are you getting, and how do you use those statistics that you're getting?
We use the statistics in grant writing. So we are primarily an organization that is donation funded. We don't get government money. So at least at this point, we don't get government money. Maybe that'll change in the future, but right now we don't. There is a local philanthropic organization that we have a matching grant with. So if we raise $20,000, they will match that $20,000. Other than that, it's little small grants here, it's little small grants there. I mean, we run on a shoestring budget.
How many people are actually using some of your other resources? You said HIV, Hep C, pregnancy testing, or referrals to, you've talked about referrals to drug programs or housing services.
A lot of them. I don't have a statistic for that, but a lot of them do. That they just take pamphlets that are available, or the people who I drive to treatment, or take to meetings with housing, or we have social workers who will come down and talk on the van. And so if there's somebody we're concerned about, we can say, hey, there's a social worker in that. We do the testing on the van, and one of our sites is actually at a church that has a weekly dinner at the same time that our program's going on, and at that weekly dinner there are social workers there to try to help get people signed up into services. So we escort a lot of people, like point them towards the church of like, hey, go in there, there's some people who can actually help you. Because I'm not a social worker, I consider myself a professional handholder.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the organizations you partner with is Planned Parenthood, and I know they're going under a little bit of partnership. How has that affected your relationship with them and your pregnancy services?
Well, the only pregnancy services we do is pregnancy testing. They mm-hmm. They provide the HIV testing and the hepatitis C testing, as well as the pregnancy testing, and at this point it has not affected it in the slightest.
Okay, thank you. I guess, does this program help reduce drug use?
Well, with getting 10% into treatment, I would say that it does, yeah.
Okay. And I know you've talked about this being on the East Coast and the West Coast. Is it starting to become more national programs, or whatever programs did you get inspiration for this program for? And oh, go ahead.
It is. It is becoming more nationally recognized as something that needs to happen across the nation. I've been lucky enough to do some advising for some other states and their programs. So hopefully that will continue to grow. And I actually worked for Syringe Exchange in Portland, Oregon, and volunteered in Seattle, Washington. And so I was able to take what I saw from their programs, and then, and their programs are wonderful. I'm not putting them down at all. But I was able to expand upon what they do, like the ride services to drug treatment. That's not something that they're able to do, but we can. And so I was able to build off of what they had already built, which are wonderful programs, and then expand upon it to meet the needs of our community.
Great. What do you hope to see the impact of what you're doing be in 5 or 10 years from now?
I would like to see that 78% of hepatitis C rate drop. That's my goal. Even if it drops by only a couple of points, I will feel a success rate.
And it sounds like it's very important for health to quit drug use.
I think it's important for health that we don't do a lot of the stuff that we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good point.
I don't think Twinkies are great for us. I don't think the people who run those 100-mile marathons, I don't think that's great for their bodies. We do a lot of stuff that's not good for us. So it's not mm-hmm. just drug use. I mean, across the board, everybody's got their coping mechanism. It's just societally, we see some coping mechanisms as worse than others. And when we make mm-hmm. things illegal, we add to the damage.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as something is socially illegal, you put a social stigma on it, which makes it harder for people to get help, to admit what mm-hmm. they're doing, and they become more isolated, and they have more emotional health issues. And so societally, I think we need to recognize that we all do stuff that's unhealthy for us and stop judging mm-hmm. it quite so much. You know, every night if I turn on the television, I see people drinking on sitcoms. Alcohol mm-hmm. is one of the worst drugs that we have out there, but people want to knock heroin addicts when almost everyone I know has a drink every night. I hate to call a spade, but if you're doing something every night, you probably have a bit of an addiction issue.
So, I mean, has some of your work then been helping to reduce the stigma around some of this, and how have you been able to start doing that?
By relating it to people, things that people relate to, be it alcohol. That's a huge one. And also relating it to other diseases. We recognize that addiction is a mental illness. It literally changes the way that your brain thinks. So it's not mm-hmm. a moral failing. It's not that you're a bad person. It's that you have a mental illness. And so mm-hmm. trying to recognize that you can't just say to somebody, hey, stop doing this. It's not that easy. You can't say to a schizophrenic, hey, stop being schizophrenic.
Now, I mean, there's also, have you been working with mental illness institutions to help reduce stigma? Because that's one of the things that mental illness advocates have been working very hard on, is to reduce the stigma of mental illness.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We definitely work with every social service agency we can.
So how can people help you in your exchange program or other exchange programs across the country?
I think volunteering is great. I think writing checks is great. These programs are incredibly underfunded. I mean, some of them are part of health departments, city or county health departments, but a lot of them are like us. We are on a shoestring budget. Sometimes we can't afford all the supplies that we need. So writing checks. I mean, I know it doesn't sound great, but it's a capitalist society. We need money. And also just talking about it, talking about the fact that we all have addicts in our family. We all have that aunt or uncle who drinks too much. You know, almost everybody I know at one point has smoked pot. Let's stop lying about the fact that people don't take drugs. We are a society that lives on drugs. That's why the pharmaceutical companies are so huge. Let's acknowledge the fact that at some point we all take something to make ourselves feel better.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience today?
I would like to share to stop scapegoating the drug dealers. You know, once again, we live in a capitalist society. And here in Cincinnati, the 96% of our clients of the exchange are white, but almost all of the dealers are young African American men, and they're fighting poverty. They're not out there because they're some big bad wolf who's preying on these poor addicts. They're out there, they're trying to pay their bills. And there's no other way that they see that they can. They get trapped in a cycle of poverty, family-wise. It's generational poverty. And the school system is incredibly racist. They get kicked out of school. Young African American men get kicked out of school more than any other group. And so they take the job that they can get. And I think we need to stop scapegoating and blaming drug dealers who are merely trying to survive in a capitalist society.
Now, are there ways that you're helping the drug dealers too? I mean, I know it might be a little bit of a different program, but it seems like, you know, they are obviously trying to meet some needs as well that they're fulfilling by selling drugs.
That's a trickier avenue to walk. I have done outreach to drug dealers just to inform them on what the laws are so they know what laws they're breaking. Because it's not like drug dealers don't know they're breaking the law, just like drug addicts know that they're breaking the law. But they don't always know what the laws are. They don't always know what they're stepping into. So having conversations with them, but at the same time maintaining my safety, because when somebody just walks up to them, and especially a middle-aged white woman, when somebody walks up to them, you know, they have no idea what I'm coming up to them to say, because so often the middle-aged white person who's calling the police on them constantly. So it's walking the fine line of maintaining my safety, their safety, but letting them know, all right, so this is the structure of the law, this is what you're doing, and this is how it could affect you for the rest of your life. Because a lot of them don't understand. You get busted for a drug crime, you can't get federal loans to go to school. Like if you want to change your life at some point and you think you'll go to college or get your GED is one thing, but you're not going to get federal loans to go to college. So making sure that they recognize the ramifications of what their actions now, because these are 18, 19-year-old boys. When I was 18 and 19, I didn't think about that stuff. You know, so trying to make sure that everybody who is involved in this whole trade is aware of what can happen.
Now, is there resources out for them to either, you know, is there employment resources? Are there ways that, you know, they can help get funding to go to school and stuff to help move forward? Or is that not exactly there, not helpful enough that it's not being that they're still doing this for a little bit?
Well, it depends on if they've been arrested. If they've been arrested, there are no resources to help them go to school, or very, very, very few. And they have to put on their down on their job application that they have a felony arrest for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's this mistake made at 18, 19 years old that follows them for the rest of their life, including limiting their ability to vote, limiting their access to housing, their jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it follows them for the rest of their lives, and I don't think that's fair. We all make mistakes when we're 20.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously been a lot of people in this country who do have drugs that have been forgiven or some other stances. So definitely there's a little bit of a controversy of why does some rules apply to some people and not others in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you. Being able to have the access to those services.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for talking with us. This is really insightful. I mean, if there's any way that we can help you with helping people find services or anything, or we can work together, it would be an honor.
Oh, yeah, totally. And we are on Facebook. We do post both our sites and our locations on Facebook weekly. I mean, we're at the same place every week, but every week we put it up anyway, as well as any fundraisers that we do. We have a website that's cincyep.org, and that's CINCYEP.org. So Cincinnati Exchange Project, just shortened down. And people can find out more about us that way. And we work with a couple of really great guys who are in recovery and make wonderful T-shirts for us, and so that helps raise our funds. And yeah, we try to do, which we'll try to meet people wherever they are at. If it's a family member who has somebody that is into the depths of addiction and they just need to talk, they can give me a call. I'll go over. I'll have coffee with them for a couple hours and talk. We want to just meet people wherever they are at and on whatever side of this they are on.
I think what you're doing is amazing. It's definitely hard. Sometimes it's easier to come in hard instead of with compassion. But for me, I know as a person who's used services, compassion is always more helpful than somebody being yelling at you. And I think what you're doing is amazing.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate you guys taking the time and reaching out to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you for talking to us. You have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.